Okay. Yeah, most people are here, so we can start the morning talk. And this morning's talk is obviously the last of the major formal talks of this retreat. And so it's nice to talk upon those things which really count. In other words, the practice of deep insight, to finding out the way of the mind, the way of the world, and also to be able to have such insight which can really change one's way of looking at things and thereby change one's life. So this is that deep insight looking at which is life changing. And that's the sort of deep insight which the Buddha was recommending and which forms the heart of this path. When I talked the last few days about the Eightfold Path, in some parts of the suttas, there's a Tenfold Path. They add an extra two factors on the end. Did you know that? This is the hidden two factors of the Eightfold Path. We only give these secret teachings at the end of a retreat. And they're not really secret. All it is the ninth factor is right wisdom, right understanding. Samanyana, a sort of an understanding, which is not just view, which is a real deep seeing. And the tenth factor is the perfect release, freedom. But it's nice to add those two factors onto the end of the Eightfold Path. It's as if the Eightfold Path is what you're doing, and the ninth and tenth factors, what happens as a result. By practicing the Eightfold Path, you get that insight wisdom, the jnana, the clear seeing into reality, seeing things as they truly are, not as they appear to be or as you want them to be, but as they truly are. And the result of that is the tenth factor, perfect freedom. And those are two factors which need to be stressed in this Eightfold Path or the Tenfold Path, because they show that this Eightfold Path is what you do to get somewhere, and to get it through insight, through wisdom. But when people use that word insight, they should really stress that word in, actually to see within, to see deep within, to see the source of things. Because so much of what people take to be insight is really excite. And that's why it excites you. It's seeing outside somewhere. And that's why it sort of stimulates the mind rather than settles it down. If it really is true insight, it sort of makes you very peaceful and calm. So there's a difference there. And again, the main reason why people don't get those sorts of deep insights is because their mind is not calm enough, not powerful enough to see deeply within themselves. And that's why that traditionally in Buddhism, that to gain that sort of insight, to say the five hindrances have to be overcome, first of all. And that's the whole job of the Eightfold Path, if you like, to overcome the five hindrances. And to get the mind in that sort of state, that it's clear and it's powerful, and it can discover insight. So the insight is the result of the Eightfold Path. I'm talking about the big insight now. And so to overcome those five hindrances which I've been talking about, which you have seen, I think, very clearly in the last 8 or 9 days, is something you should know about what you've been doing so far, is the hindrances, their power, and just how sneaky they are sometimes. Just when sometimes you think you're getting peaceful, sometimes a thought might come up, a desire, a wanting, and that's a hindrance which stops you becoming in, getting into deep meditation. Or sometimes a little bit of ill will towards yourself, which manifests as impatience. That's a form of ill will, impatience. And to see those as hindrances just shows you just how insidious and how difficult are these hindrances to really overcome. And to gain insight, all the teachers, all the texts, always say that without abandoning the five hindrances, there is no insight, there's no wisdom. So that should be one's preliminary job, to try and overcome these five hindrances. And the way those five hindrances are overcome is by what I've been teaching here this week, is through the jhanas. Traditionally, they say that where the five hindrances are overcome is called upachara samadhi. They call it like neighborhood concentration, neighborhood samadhi, where you're just right next to jhanas, but not fully in them. It's like the entrance to this hall over here. You have to pass over the entrance, the neighborhood to the door to come into this room. And also you have to pass over it as you go out. These are upachara neighborhoods. Now, one of the mistakes which people make with understanding insight meditation is that they think that so the neighborhood as you go into jhana is a place where you should do insight. Just stop a bit short of jhana and try and do insight then. And that is one type of upachara, but that is a very difficult one and very unstable, because you're not really quite sure whether those five hindrances have been fully overcome or not. You're not really sure whether you are in that upachara samadhi where insight can truly happen, because those hindrances are extremely sneaky at that stage. They can manifest just so easily. And also, if there is a state just before jhana, because of the way of the mind, it's very unstable. You can fall back so quickly. It is why that some people misunderstand or fail to recognize that there is two upacharas. There is the one on the way into jhana, and there's the one on the way out of jhana. In the same way, you pass over the threshold of that door on the way in and also on the way out. And of those two, it's that upachara samadhi after jhana which has the qualities of being certain and long-lasting. Having trained yourself in this way, you know what jhanas are, and you know that state just afterwards is what the texts call the upachara samadhi. And from your experience, you will know that that state lasts much, much longer. It's more stable than any type of upachara samadhi just before you arrive. It's because that when you are experiencing the jhanas, when you're right inside them, it's as if that the five hindrances have been completely knocked out and made unconscious. You slug them. And the longer you stay in that jhana, the deeper the slug. And so much so that when you come out after the jhanas, they are just still KO'd. They're knocked out. They're unconscious. They're inactive. You've beaten them down. And very often, if you spend a long time in a jhana, they're beaten down for a long, long, long period of time. And anyone who's had a very nice meditation, especially jhana, would know that the state afterwards, the happiness, the joy, the clarity, lasts a long time, effortlessly. Because you're full of energy, you're full of clarity, you're full of power. And that is the state where insight can be found, where insight is made. You have to be careful sometimes of that state after jhanas, because sometimes the experience is so powerful and so beautiful, and sometimes the hindrances are knocked out, sometimes for days. The days after you get a nice jhana, you just got no desire for things of the world. Even the food on your plate, you can take it or leave it, and you don't really care. And you have no sloth and torpor, you can sit till late in the night, get up early in the morning, you're so mindful, perfectly, hour after hour, day after day. There's no ill will can come up, even a mosquito comes, you sort of welcome it. Please come and take some of my blood. Out of compassion for all the other people out there. Here, come on, come and take something. You've got so much compassion because the mind is so high and full of joy. And sometimes people think that those states are full enlightenment. You think you're enlightened. But I know that that's happened to me before. You know, I wrote about it in that book, Seeing the Way, where I had a nice meditation one evening and just after that, I just wasn't tired at all. And when you lay down to sleep, you were just so mindful. You didn't really need to sleep. Just laying down there on the side, just watching the breath, and just feeling so much happiness and being so peaceful. When you did go off to sleep, it was only for a very short time, You woke up afterwards, and immediately you woke up. It's completely mindful. Not like it was this morning. Not, oh, here we go again. What should I be doing? Where am I? They're completely mindful and getting up and going to the hall before 3 o'clock, well before the bell, and sitting meditation there. And just going to nice samadhi all morning. It's great. And I thought, at last, this is it. Ah, oh, great. And it's nice to think you're enlightened. It's quite a nice way to start the day. And then, some of you know the story, what happened next. As I went on arms around, I was just perfectly mindful, enjoyed it. There's no sort of defilements in the mind at all. It was so clear until it came to the meal time. And meals are very, very good to see if you've got any defilements coming up, especially if it's only your one meal of the day, and that's all you're going to get. And this was in a monastery in the northeast of Thailand. It was a very poor monastery, away from the cities or towns. And usually, what we used to get every day, the same meal day after day, was like sticky rice and what they called rotten fish curry. And it was called rotten fish for two reasons. First of all, it was fish which was pickled. It was caught during the rainy season. And they put it in a jar and close it up and just leave it to ferment. So it was like sort of ripe fish. And it was rotten because that's how it tasted. It was really awful stuff. You got sort of used to it, but not really used to it. And so you'd have this every day, rotten fish curry with your rice, so that's all you had. But this one day, it just happened to happen just after I became enlightened, in inverted commas, that somebody made this pork curry. There was no vegetarian food in those places. They had a pork curry as well as the rotten fish curry. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, I'm going to have something nice to eat today. And the abbot, I was second in line, the abbot, the head monk, this Thai monk, he sort of took out sort of, you know, these really big scoops of this pork curry, huge scoops, and put it in his bowl. And I thought, that's really greedy, but I thought, it doesn't matter, there's plenty left for me. But what he did next was, after taking out two huge scoops for himself, and he didn't take any of the rotten fish curry, he was a northeasterner, a local, even he didn't like it. But what he said next, he said, well, you know, sort of it's all the same, isn't it? Whatever curry it is, it's all just the four elements. And then he sort of poured all the two curries together and mixed them up. And I was thinking, if you really thought that, why didn't you mix them up before you took yours? Now I haven't got any nice food today, and I got really angry at this monk. Really sort of livid at him, sort of, why can you do this? You know, you're taking away my nice meal. It's not all every day we get this nice pork curry. And you're a northeasterner. I've come from the west. I'm not used to rotten fish. You should be used to rotten fish. Why are you mixing it all up? And then, sort of, what stopped me getting more and more angry? Because I realized, hang on, I'm supposed to be enlightened. And, oh, dear. And that really makes you depressed once you find out you're not enlightened after all. That spoiled my whole day. But that's what happens sometimes. Because, like, for many hours, the defilements are just gone. And you're just so clear and bright. And you think, wow, this is it. This is the way it should be. Perfectly clear and peaceful and light. It's just samadhi experience. So, and be careful sometimes. And you don't go back and say you're enlightened. Because little things like the defilements or the hindrances, well, sooner or later, once they've recovered, they'll come up and they'll play around with you again, take you around by the nose. But the important thing with that upachara samadhi, which is after jhana, that is the time to really get into deep insight, because your mind is powerful. The mind has energy. It has clarity, and the five hindrances aren't there. This is a time when you can see what you don't want to see, what you don't expect to see, because all that wanting and all that expecting has been subdued. And you know it's been subdued because you've gained that jhana. I think many of you know how expectations and wants are the very barriers which stop you gaining those nimittas and entering samadhi. And so by training yourself to subdue those wants and expectations, those desires, they are not cold, they disappear. You enter jhana, and when you come out again, they're still not around. And because there's no wanting, there's no expectations, Then you can see what's truly there, rather than what you want to see or what you expect to see. That's where deep insight arises. The expectations are as much a hindrance to jhanas as they are to insight. That's why when an insight happens, this is one of the characteristics of it, it'll always be something which you never expected. Quite different than what you thought it would be. That's why it's called an insight. You're seeing something from a fresh angle. Something new, something completely different. However, there are ways of encouraging those insights to happen, especially after the jhanas. And the way to encourage them, and this is, if you read carefully in the suttas, the words of the Buddha, this is how the Buddha taught, get the jhanas. And he said, standing on that experience, he said, develop the insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and not self. But standing on that experience, using that experience both as your power source and as also your data to investigate these three areas of reality. And those three areas, again, impermanence, it's wider than impermanence. I'll mention a bit more about anicca and suffering and non-self. The impermanence, the first thing which one can really watch, is the uncertainty of everything. Because one of the meanings of anicca, or of its opposite, nicca, is something which is regular, which is certain, which is always there, something which you can rely upon. And the opposite, anicca, means things which are there, they suddenly disappear, which are unreliable, irregular. And it's interesting, like contemplating that word, anicca, unreliable, because how often do we seek for something to rely upon in this world? Some little place of security, something which we think is always going to be there for us to come home to, either physically or mentally. Some sort of refuge inside the mind or inside the world, a place of safety, or a thing of security. What anicca is doing is saying all of that is insecure, is insubstantial, is irregular. You cannot rely upon it. The tendency of the human being is maybe to admit that a lot of the world is unreliable, but to seek some sort of secure place, or secure person, or secure mind state, which you think is reliable and which is always going to be there. That's why some people look for partners in the world. Someone you can rely upon. Someone who's always going to be there for you. You know, a soulmate. But all soulmates eventually disappear. They go. They too are unreliable. As you find out when you marry one. But not only that, the people sometimes have rely on places and things. The little hideaways, the nice little houses, the little nests. And even those are unreliable. Eventually they will disappear as well. But we also have the little nest inside of our mind. Some little place inside where we rely upon. And even that, anicca, when it gets in there, reveals that even that is insecure. That's why anicca, when you see it clearly, is quite frightening. It brings up the feeling of complete insecurity. There's no place where you can stand. No place where you can sit down. Everything is always changing. And because of the fear which arises when one starts to look at anicca, it means that unless you've got the powerful mind states of jhanas or post-jhanas, you'll never be able to pass through that fear and get to reality. There'll always be some part of existence you will think is secure, reliable, permanent. And that's why we aren't enlightened. Sometimes we think it's not very nice to realize insecurity. It's wonderful to realize the truth of insecurity for two reasons. One, because when you know you haven't got a home, in all senses of that word, then you can be like a bird and fly everywhere. Every place is a tree where you can rest for a while. You never think that you own that particular tree, and that's mine, and you other birds keep out. You can share. Then It also means that when you realize that all these things are completely changing, when they do change, when they do disappear, when things alter, you're never surprised. You realize that this is actually the truth of things. That insecurity is actually a freedom. Security is like being in prison, being bonded to something. So after a while, one gets quite a sense of relief with insecurity. A sense of being able to fly and being able to go wherever one wishes, rather than being bound down. And so this is what happens when we look at anicca. It gives us the sense that all this is coming and going. But there's nothing which is stable. No place where we can rest on. But in particular, that the anicca, which is going to discover that third aspect of the three characteristics of existence, of anatta, that is the anicca which is very difficult to apply. Because that's anicca which is applied to the one who's seeing anicca. And sometimes to see the one who's seeing is just so difficult. It's just like trying to catch an eel. It's just so slithery and slippery. As soon as you catch it, it's slithered away again. Or it's like a dog trying to chase its tail. You know, the self trying to see the self. The self trying to see the self. And this is why seeing anicca in the doer, in the seer, is just so hard to do. This is, again, one of the reasons we don't like to do this, because one of the reasons we can't do this is because we don't want to do it, we don't like to do it. We'd rather not see the insubstantiality of everything. It's just too frightening, it's just too challenging, it's just cutting too deep. So the only way that can actually happen is if after good meditation, which is so peaceful, because we're so happy, we're so joyful, that happiness and joy overcomes any fear, and we can go so deep into insight. In the same way, this is you've heard me tell this before, about the only way that you can be open to hearing things you don't want to hear, to criticism, for example, is when you're in a good mood. If you're in a really good mood and you're very high, then I can tell you anything which is wrong with you, even personal things, and you don't mind. That's why I tell people who are in relationships with husbands and wives, if it's something very difficult, you have to tell your partner some criticism which you think they might not really take very well, and take them out to a dinner. Dress up really nicely, take them out to a really nice dinner, sort of give them the very best food, you know, what they really like. And then, when they're on the last course, when they're really nice and happy, just all soft and smiley, you can tell them anything. And they'll accept it. You can get all sorts of criticism, you know, which is personal and otherwise. And because they're happy, because they're relaxed, they can listen. They don't feel challenged. But if you tell them when they've just come home from work after a hard day, that's it, I'm calling the lawyers, this is divorce. This is what happens, because when you're feeling happy, when you're feeling relaxed, you're more open to seeing or hearing what you don't want to hear or see. In the same way, when you've had a good meditation, everything's nice and peaceful, and you've got so much happiness, then you're much more open to seeing those insights which normally you would never even allow yourself to contemplate. There's no one here. Life is suffering. Everything is impermanent. Those that challenge you, take like the suffering of life. This goes completely against the grain. Life is beautiful. Life is a bowl of cherries. Life is out there for you to enjoy. Go and experience. If you can't actually go there, get a video on it. There's so many ways to enjoy yourself in this world. We've even got like virtual reality now. Soon. I remember in the last retreat, somebody asked me this because they were into all this high-tech stuff. I said, soon you'll be able to get virtual jhanas. Just put on this little mask and press a little button, and all these beautiful nimittas will come up and they'll lead you into virtual jhanas. So you don't need to sort of sit on the floor and waste all this 9 days, 10 days, just do it in half an hour at a virtual reality store. I'm sure that someone will try that one these days. But that's not the way it works. We like it to have the easy way, but sometimes it takes a lot of giving up, letting go. But to actually to see suffering is we're seeing something which we, by its very nature, don't want to see. You know, I was talking about perceptions the other day, actually right throughout the retreat. There was a very fascinating experiment done, I think it was at Harvard, with the way that the mind perceives things, where they flashed images on a screen, got, you know, a few volunteer students to see, in the sit and see what was going on with the notepad by their side. And first of all, they flashed these images on the screen so fast that there wasn't really time to really understand them. It was just a flash on the screen. And they asked these students to write down, you know, what they perceived. And all they could say was a flash of light, that's all. And then they increased the exposure on the screen, you know, from a hundredth of a second to 200ths of a second. What did you see? Still a flash. And they kept on increasing the time of exposure on the screen incrementally until there was a flash there and they could catch something. And they could perceive something and then they could write down what it was. And then they kept on increasing it until they could see it more clearly and then they would write down what it was. There's some very interesting things happened when they kept on increasing exposure more and more and more. That at a very early exposure length, when they thought they understood it, what was there, they continued, where the exposure length was increased, they continued writing the same thing. They kept on seeing it in exactly the same way. One of the examples they gave, there was the actual photograph, the still photograph, was a bicycle on the stairs going up to one of the lecture halls. And one of the students, it was briefly shown on the screen, and they perceived it as a ship. Now, it's quite easy to do this because, and it's obviously, it's just very quickly, and the perception just grasped, you know, something, and it said it was a ship. But the interesting thing was, as the exposure was increased, incrementally, bit by bit, he still said it was a ship, a ship, a ship, a ship, a ship, a ship. And at times when on every person, if it was exposed at that particular length, they would say, it's a bicycle on the stairs. They would still see it as a ship. Their old perceptions had imprinted themselves so deeply on the mind, they actually saw that image according to their old views. And it took them a really long exposure on the screen to finally change their old ideas and see it, hey, it's not a ship after all. It's a bicycle on the steps going to a lecture hall. What was interesting there was how, through the perceptions we have, we form these very strong views which make us see the whole world to conform to those views, even though they're completely wrong. That's why it's so difficult to catch the illusions of self, the illusions of suffering, the illusions of anicca. We need to have that strong exposure, not just for a second, for long periods of time, to see, hang on, we've been seeing it in the wrong way. It's not a ship after all, it's just a bicycle on the steps. It's not a self after all, it's just a process. Life is not such a bowl of cherries. Life is a bowl of rotten eggs, whatever it is. And yes, so the other interesting thing about this experiment, which they did, they found the images which were repulsive, which were abhorrent, it took people much, much longer exposures to see them as they truly were. One of the images they showed on the screen was like two copulating dogs. And that took the longest of all the images for them to really finally figure out what it was. The reason was because they didn't want to see that. That was repulsive. If it was like a beautiful model, they'd have seen that in a couple of seconds. But if it was something repulsive, they didn't want to see it, and therefore they didn't see it. Now that was really fascinating, because that was reinforcing what the Buddha's been saying for 25 centuries. That with the hindrances operating, we only see what we want to see. We don't see what's real. And sometimes the exposure needs to be so long and right in front of our face before we finally admit to what's truly going on in the world. But with suffering. This is the problem. We don't want to see suffering. Therefore, we don't see it. We live in a fantasy world that life is happy. You get married, and you're happy ever after. You get the perfect relationship. I remember one lady was kept on telling me, no matter what I said to her about Buddhism, she said, "I know he's out there somewhere, the perfect man for me. I just have not met him yet. I don't know where he is. I know he's out there somewhere." And she was in her late 40s, and she's still so stupid. The people live in fantasy land most of the time, not real at all. Or the people who think that if you can get the right medicine, you never need to die. And aging is just something which is healable, curable. It's not necessary. All of these ideas, these fantasies which people have, are just not being real. And so that when we start looking at the truth of dukkha, we have to be very courageous to see that. Not just courageous, but we have to be very sneaky as well. And again, this is why we do something like the jhana meditation. We feel so happy, so peaceful, just like the husband and wife when they've been taken out by their partner to a beautiful dinner, and they're feeling so rested, so at peace, they're actually open to hearing or seeing what they didn't want to hear, they didn't want to see. That's how you sneak up on dukkha, and you can finally accept it. In particular, there's one particular area of dukkha which we don't want to see. At least we think that we're happy. That's why when you go home from this retreat, it doesn't matter how much suffering you have on a retreat, when you go home again, you say, "It was really worthwhile, it was really good. It was really, really worthwhile." Because you look such a fool if you go back and say, "It was really terrible and suffering. I spent all this money on this." Even on retreats where you have to go through a lot of physical pain, you know, you get conned, didn't it, to say, "Well, it's a lot of pain, but it's really useful. I really discovered something wonderful here." If you didn't say that, you'd be really embarrassed that you've been wasting your time all the 9 days and 10 days. The same as when you go on holiday. Everyone who goes on holiday, when they come back again afterwards, and a friend says, "How was it? I had a wonderful time." Even though you're lying through your teeth. Even though you had a terrible time, because it makes you sound so foolish if you were honest and said, "A terrible time going through the customs, the hotel was rotten, it rained all the time, I had arguments with the person I went to, I had a really terrible time." You feel such a fool. And also, it's just not done, it's not our custom. Everyone knows that when you come back from holiday, you say, "You had a wonderful time." Everyone knows when you write a postcard to your friends, "Having a wonderful time, wish you were here." No one says, "I'm a rotten time, wish I was back home." No one says that. So sometimes you be careful just the way that we lie. We don't face reality because of our social conditioning. It's the same as if you... I think it's a bit better these days, but if you go to a funeral. I mean, I've been giving funeral services for a long time. Even me, it took me many years to finally get the courage to tell a joke at a funeral service. You know I like telling jokes. Because it's not done, is it, to tell jokes at funeral service? You can do it sort of other times, any other time. But the one place you're not supposed to tell a joke is when there's a stiff in the coffin. It's a bit disrespectful, isn't it? But actually, when I did get the courage to do it, all the people, the very first time I told a joke at a funeral service, all of the relations would have said, "Oh, thank you so much." One, because it made us feel good. And they say, the person who died, they were always telling jokes as well, and they would have really appreciated that one. I'm sure I could hear the coffin rattling as they were laughing. They appreciated it. But sometimes we have these taboos, which are incredibly difficult to break. And one of those taboos is facing up to the life of suffering. That's a taboo which people don't want to recognize. And that's why you have to creep up on it and find that all this world is all suffering. You know, the taboo is like looking at a sunset or a beautiful flower. And it's really challenging to say all flowers, even the most beautiful flower, is suffering. And people think you're just crazy, or you're weird, or you're just, you know, you've been a monk too long. You should sort of come back into the real world. It's a taboo there that flowers are beautiful. Everyone knows that. The sun. But this is where you do need to have that ability to go against preconceived notions which go so deep inside of you, you won't believe just how deeply they're embedded in you. And the most deeply embedded notion is not the idea that life is happiness, but that you are. That's the deepest notion, which is the hardest one to eradicate. The anatta, that I am. And that view is just so tricky, so slippy. It's just like trying to, what you might say, just that, trying to, no, not shoot the bird through the eye with an arrow, but trying to shoot it a million miles away with an arrow and get right through the middle of the eye. It's just so tricky to see this self, this me. And this is why the Buddha gave, not just the jhanas, to give the mind power and to be able to make it see what it doesn't want to see. But he also gave the four satipatthanas as a way of not wasting time, to actually to focus on four areas where the illusion of self really hangs out. Because there's many places you might try and look for the illusion of self, but the four main areas were, you know, the rupa, your body, and vedana, the feeling, the mind, this jitta, that which knows, and the mental objects, especially the doer, will. Those are the four areas. And so, having heard a teaching like the Satipatthana, having practiced the Eightfold Path, when a mind is in jhanas, and it comes out afterwards, see if you can remember to employ the Satipatthana, especially for one purpose, and one purpose only, not to see anicca, but to see anatta, not self. That is the deepest, most fundamental block which is stopping you being enlightened, which stops you being free. One of the ways which I practice myself and teach other people to practice is to ask yourself this question, not is there a self, that's just too philosophical, but to ask yourself, what do I take to be myself? Who do I think I am? Who do I perceive I am? What is this me I assume to exist? When you ask that question, whatever comes up as an answer, challenge you. Am I this body? I look in the mirror every morning, two fingers and smile, there I am again. Is that me, this body? Sometimes we're very sophisticated and intellectual. We think, of course we're not our body. On the thought level, we might say that. But when we get sick or we're dying, we realize that that's just superficial wisdom. It hasn't gone deep enough. We are still attached to our body. We still think it's mine. The Buddha gave a test to see whether you really are attached to these things, whether you think they're mine. This is a story when he was walking with some monks in the Jeta grove. And he pointed out to some twigs and leaves on the ground. And he said, monks, what would happen? How would you feel if some people came along and collected all these twigs and leaves and put them into a big heap and then set fire to them all? And then once the fire had died down, take all the ashes and throw them to the four winds. So they got completely dispersed. What would your reaction be if they did that? And the monk said, nothing, because these things aren't ours, they don't belong to us, it's just sticks and leaves, that's all. Ah, very good, said the Buddha. Now, monks, what would happen if the lay people took all of you and put you on a heap and set you afire until you're all just ashes, and then threw those ashes to the four winds? Would you be upset? Would you be really worried? And according to the text, the monks, I don't know if they actually really meant this, but they certainly knew the right answer. They said, no, we would be at all worried. Why is that, monks? Because This body isn't ours. Nothing to do with us. It's not me or mine. But that's a test. If you really see this body as a self, whether you're willing to let it go or not. That's why when we say, look at the body in the four satipatthanas, don't run over that too quickly and say, oh yeah, I've done that one already. I know this body isn't me or mine. It's just bones. It's just flesh. I've seen that in the documentaries. I've seen that in the photographs. But be careful. Because you've been living with this body so closely for many years, there's a little sneaky attachment that's gone in there. And you really think that this is you. And that gets challenged through sickness, old age and death. And if you tremble at sickness or pain, if you tremble at the thought of old age or death, you still need to do some more body contemplation. So, when there's a big jhana happens and afterwards, you say, what do I take to be me? And look at this body. And just see those little attachments, even though they were stupid, something which you could not see because you didn't want to see it. And eradicate completely the idea that the body is yours or you. It's just nature, belongs to nature. You've got nothing much to do with it. The second thing about the Vedana is sensations. Don't take them just too lightly. This is obvious that this isn't me. Every time you have happiness or pain, do you automatically think, this is my happiness? This is me feeling it? If you do, again, you haven't seen the truth of anatta. After jhanas, look closely at this whole play of Vedana. And you see, it's just like the play of light and shadows cast by the trees and the leaves. Where there's light, there's no shadow. Where there's shadow, there's no light. And as the leaves move in the wind, as the sun goes over, what was light is now shadow. What is shadow is now light. What was pain is now pleasure. What is beauty is now ugliness. What was ugliness is now beauty. This is a play of Vedana. It's no more than that. Seeing that means, if you see it fully, through the power of jhanas, you've done that second satipatthana and you are completely detached. Detached means that there's no one holding on to the Vedana, the pleasure or pain. Remember, a lot of people think attachment is all about what's out there. The cause of attachment is not so much what's out there, it's what's holding on inside. The claw, I call it. It's a claw inside which keeps on going outside into the world, attaching to things. No matter how many times you put things down, let go, you let go, you let go, you'll never be able to end attaching until you see that claw and cut it off. It's the claw which needs to be looked at, seen, and eradicated. That's the only way to stop attaching once and for all. And that claw is the illusion that all these things belong to us, especially Vedana here. You see, this is just the play of nature. In the same way that a person who understands why there's light and why there's shadow under a tree realizes it's nothing to do with them. And they leave the light and shadow alone, knowing if they prefer one or the other, that soon they will change. If you prefer suffering or if you prefer happiness, it doesn't matter, you'll just change. And then we go back again, up and down, coming and going. That's pleasure and pain in life. So after the jhana, you do the second satipatthana. You're investigating this Vedana, seeing it as it truly is, not as you want it to be, realizing it's completely out of your control. No matter how wise, skillful, powerful you are, the idea of just getting pleasant Vedana and avoiding all the unpleasant, you see, it's a complete impossibility. It goes against nature. It cannot be done. So you give up. You let go. Also, to one of the deeper places where a person thinks their self exists, I've already mentioned this, is the will. That's part of the fourth satipatthana, the doer. the chooser. That's a very hard thing to see. You can see its results with all of the controlling, the disturbing, which has been going on for the last 9 days, caused by this seeing the doer. But even so, it's so hard to give this thing up. Even so, that you know that letting go is the way into jhana. You can't somehow achieve that letting go. You can't do the letting go. I might say I call it that way, describe it that way. It's obvious why you can't do the letting go. You have to allow it to happen. The biggest problem people have with the jhanas is they try and do it. They try and control it. They try and will it. They try and steer their vehicle into a jhana. You've got to have your hands completely off the steering wheel. In fact, you've got to dismantle the steering wheel before you get into jhanas. There's an entry fee to jhanas. Something you have to give up at the door. And that's you. A lot of people, they like to go into jhanas. They like to be there at the same time. They want to take the doer in there. Have control. And that's why they can't get in. That's why it takes a leap of faith somewhere, confidence, to get into a jhana. You see the beautiful jhana in there, and you want to go in, but you want to take you with you, and you can't, and you can't. So after a while, it looks so beautiful, you leave you outside, you just go in and have fun. And then you realize just how you, the doer, has been such a burden, has been such a terrible companion for you, causing all sorts of pain and suffering. What the Buddha called a house builder. And once you've been in a jhana, you've fed upon it afterwards, you'll never trust this doer so much again. You never trust that within you, which is even now trying to do something. Think something, say something, control something. But that doer, to see that as not you, non-self, to see it completely cause, arises and passes away according to natural laws again. If you can see that, then you've got a very powerful insight. Half, 50% of the illusion of self is completely gone. And life becomes so much easier. You can flow with things rather than always controlling them, because you haven't got faith in the doer anymore. You can let go. The last place, which is hard for a person to see, is again the consciousness itself, the mind. This mind, which a lot of people talk about, which I talk about a lot, to actually see it in its purity is very, very difficult. You see it in jhanas. What's important after a jhana is having known what the citta is, the mind. What the Buddha talks so much about in the suttas, having seen that, then to apply the satipatthana. Reflect on the mind and ask yourself, is this me? That which knows, that which is hearing this, which feels the aches and pains in the body, which sees the sights around, which sees the flowers and the sunsets, that which sees and experiences, is that what I take to be me? And look at this whole process of consciousness, the screen on which experience is played out. Like the television simile which I gave yesterday. The television is the screen on which all these images and all these channels are played out. When we're looking at the images, we cannot really be conscious, or we cannot really be noticing the screen. When it's just images there, the screen has disappeared. We're just focusing on images. When the five senses are playing around, that's all we see. We cannot see the screen on which all these images is being played out. In jhanas, you see the screen. And also you start to see the screen dismantle itself. The screen, which we call consciousness, begins to disappear. Higher and higher in the jhanas, more of the screen goes, until the last of the jhanas, nirodha cessation, is the cessation of the screen. Consciousness is now gone. To see that consciousness going is a very powerful experience. According to the suttas, anyone who experiences that state, the cessation of consciousness, through these jhanas, I don't mean the cessation of consciousness through going to sleep at night. I mean the cessation through jhanas. Seeing it that way, he says, when you emerge out from that state, always, automatically, you're either a non-returner or a fully enlightened arahant. There's only those two possibilities. Because having seen the cessation of consciousness itself, you will never, ever, it's impossible to be able to take that as a self, as a me. You've seen that that thing, you know, the thing we were talking about yesterday, the claw, you know, that is a good symbol. I should have mentioned it last night. You know, the thing in the Adams family, the hand always grabbing onto things. That's attachment. That thing is attachment. You see that that thing, whether it's consciousness or the doer, it's not you. Cannot be. And the last citadel of the illusion of self is broken into. Seem to be empty. And then you know that that which you took to be a self for so long was just an empty process. And that's all. That insight of into anatta is the insight which arises as a stream winner. It's entering the stream, being a stream winner. It's the insight which sees that you have taken something to be the self, to be me and mine for so many years, and you just could not see it before. Now you can. That's what insight is. And to gain that insight is very beautiful and wonderful, because once you realize there's no one here, then the whole idea of cessation, of nirvana being just a flame going out, never scares you anymore. Instead of being something completely stupid and awful, something you're not really interested in at all, because why do I want to sort of, what's the point of getting enlightened if you're not there to enjoy it? You know, what's the point of just snuffing out and going? There's too many things to do in the world, too many things to achieve, too many things to experience. But the idea of nirvana is just snuffing out, going out, only makes that sense, becomes attractive, becomes the obvious thing, only when one sees the truth of non-self. There's no one here anyway. That which you take to be you is just an illusion. Once you see that, then that is the insight, the powerful deep insight, on which all these subsequent insights which lead to the higher stages of enlightenment are based. This is what one should be doing. This is the purpose of jhanas, the purpose of those reflections. Ask yourself, what do I take to be me? Who do I think I am? What do I perceive, think, and view myself as? In terms of the four satipatthana. Then afterwards you become enlightened. And if you think those people who have had happiness through jhana experiences or deep nimittas during this retreat, if you think that's happiness, and wait till you get into a nice, powerful enlightenment insight. That's much more happiness. So the best is yet to come. So that's insight and what's actually happening. Through the eight practice of the Eightfold Path, you get samma, jnana, the correct deep insights, and samma vimutti, freedom. Has anyone got any questions on that? Questions or comments? Inside, yes. What's the difference between jnana and panya? The way that word is used, mostly by the Buddha, the panya is more like ordinary wisdom. Wisdom which sees much of things, but it's not the powerful, deep seeing. It's like the Eskimos have so many different, sorry, Inuits have so many different words for snow. In Buddhism they have very many different words for wisdom, for understanding. So jnana is almost like a root word, right? Just to know, but it's used in the sense of like deep wisdom. You have sort of panya, which is like ordinary wisdom, sometimes even the wisdom which you learn at school, is that wisdom or the wisdom of your job. That sort of knowledge. you have even like from the same root comes vijnana, consciousness, being able to sort of be conscious to know things through these senses. You've got sanya, which comes from the same root. You've got parinya, which is like full knowledge, all around knowledge. They have all different ways of sort of saying knowledge in Buddhism. And it's this one is a jnana, which is always that which is like the enlightening wisdom. That makes sense? It's like Bodhi jnana means the jnana of Bodhi, the jnana of enlightenment, enlightenment wisdom. So it was the second monk, Jnana Dhamma. The monk who likes to have a yarn. I shouldn't say that. That's a good point. It's if you've emerged from a jhana, you've got perfect mindfulness, the five hindrances completely overcome, you sometimes go in, back into a jhana, and the answer is yes. Very often that happens. You just, after a jhana's experience, you come out again. And straight away the mind, what am I doing coming out? It goes back in again. There's nothing to stop you going in. Because the five hindrances are completely gone. That's why I said, that's always the acid test of whether the five hindrances are fully overcome. Whether the door to jhanas are completely open to you. Just tell the mind to go in and it can. That's because the five hindrances, that's why they're called hindrances, they're hindering jhanas, they're obstructing wisdom. That's why an arahat put in light and be no hindrances at all. You go to jhana any time you want. That's why the question is, why don't they always go to jhanas? The question was, why do they come out in the first place? Yeah? Yeah. So, what was the first part of the question, sir? Yes. They say the achievement of a jhana, is that a guarantee of achieving the jhana again? On a deep level, I say it is a guarantee. If you achieve one, eventually you're going to achieve another. But it's not a guarantee you'll achieve a jhana in the next hit. Sometimes, not even in the same retreat, sometimes it takes a while before you sort of can get back to those same states. Now, once you come out of a jhana, immediately you come out of a jhana, the hindrances are still overcome. And sometimes, depending on the depth and power of the jhana, the hindrances can be overcome for long periods of time, even for many days. And because of that, it means that throughout that time, any time you want to go back into that jhana, you can. So sometimes that's why people think they're enlightened, because the access to the door to jhanas is completely open whenever they want. And just gain bliss at any time. So because of that, they think, wow, this is an amazing state of mind to be in. They think it's enlightenment, full enlightenment. But after a while that wears off and the hindrances come back. And they find that they really do prefer pork curry than fish curry. Oh. Yes? I think so, yes. I know this is obviously the case of the Buddha. Once he was sitting under the Bodhi tree and did all the jhanas and gained his insight. And then for the next many days, just went in and out of jhana, just experiencing the bliss of the thing. And it was days before someone could go and talk to him. He was completely absorbed with the bliss of those things. But not quite sure if it happens, a person goes into a jhana and comes out and has the good fortune to get a stream winner and then goes back in again. Then they're probably just so pissed out with being a stream winner. They'll be sort of contemplating that dharma for quite a while before they go back into any more jhanas. Why do the hindrances come back if you've got into a jhana and then you come out again, maybe go in again? It's because you've literally knocked out the hindrances, but, I mean, they haven't been really eradicated. It's just like a person's been knocked unconscious, they haven't been really killed or slain. It's only a matter of time when they come back up again. So they haven't been eradicated, they've been suppressed. So eventually they have to come back in to play around again. And sometimes it's because when one gets into those beautiful states of mind, because one stops guarding the mind, one thinks the hindrances are gone, and gets into a little heedlessness. One thinks, oh, I'm fine now, there's no hindrances. Now the gatekeeper can take a holiday. And when the gatekeeper takes a holiday, everybody, first of all, the very refined hindrances come in, first of all. The ones dressed up as your friends. And then, these are the other ones coming afterwards. That's how it happens. Does that make sense to you? Sort of? If you continue to go into jhana, then the hindrances will continue to be overcome. There is a sense, though, I suppose, that of the mind feeling satisfied with just the bliss of the jhana. This is enough. I mean, already a couple of people experience that, just the bliss is sometimes a bit too much. You know, it's a nice thing to actually decide, isn't it, to contemplate. You just get so much bliss, you won't think you can take any more. I mean, encouraging people, don't worry, you can take even more than that. But sometimes that's the thought which comes up, this is enough, and become a heedless as a result. I just like, I suppose, the not seeing the Dhamma completely, wrong view. That makes sense? Okay, yeah? Only an arahat has fully eradicated all the hindrances, yeah. That's right. The non-return is a little bit of udicca, restlessness still there. But it's just so small, you can usually get into jhanas any time for the anagami. That's a non-return. But it's still some. That's why they're saying it's like standing on the shore, your feet are still in water, you're not really on dry land yet, but you're the nearest dammit. So there's not much between the non-return and the arahat. Okay, I think that's enough for today. So you've heard all about it, now go and do it. So this is how to become enlightened, and you never know how close you are. Everyone, before they have any enlightenment experience or even a jhana, they never expect that at the beginning of the sitting that this is going to be the one. Never do they think that. And then they have the sitting and this is the one. So, you never know. Okay, so that's the end of the talk here. There are some interviews this morning.